Ole Budsberg. The other two timepieces were likewise presumed to be those of Bell's victims. Now, as Schultz worked his sluice, other watches came to light, five more over the course of the next 2 weeks, making a total of eight. As far as State's Attorney Smith was concerned, these finds settled one of the biggest questions about Bell's crimes. Contradicting theories that at least a dozen additional corpses would be discovered in her hog lot, Smith asserted his confident belief that the graveyard of Mrs. Bell Ganesse has surrendered its last victim. I base this belief, he explained, on the number of watches found in the debris. Eight watches have been recovered. It is the evidence of people who were employed by Mrs. Ganesse and who, by the working of a seeming miracle, escaped her execution room, that this queen of crime possessed a mania for collecting watches. It is reasonable to believe that each one of her victims possessed a watch, and that she came into possession of a watch with the taking of the life of each new applicant for her matrimonial favors. Over the next few weeks, Sheriff Smutzer would do some desultory digging around the property. He would find a man's skull in an abandoned privy vault, apparently the discarded head of one of the decapitated victims previously unearthed. Some hogs, rooting in the yard, turned up a couple of human bones, but as Smith had predicted, no more bodies would be found. On Saturday, May 16th, the body of the first victim exhumed from the Ganesse graveyard was returned to the earth. Andrew Helgeline's remains had been transferred to the Cutler mortuary, where they awaited official identification. On Friday night, May 15th, Edward A. Evans, the Chicago Police Department's specialist in Bertillon measurements, the standard system of forensic identification at the time, soon to be superseded by fingerprinting, examined the dismembered parts. Using Bertillon records obtained from Minnesota's Stillwater Penitentiary, where Helgeline had done 10 years for burglary and arson, Evans confirmed that the remains were those of the South Dakota farmer. Placed in a casket that had been paid for by Osla Helgeline, who, before returning home, had left $200 for his brother's funeral, the body was loaded into Cutler's dead wagon and driven out to Patton Cemetery, where it was stored overnight in the vault. The following morning, at around 10 o'clock, a brief service was conducted at the gravesite by Reverend August Johnson, pastor of the Swedish Lutheran Church. As he reached the passage, "For dust thou art, and unto dust shall thou return," one of the participants, Charles H. Michael, proprietor of a local hotel, laid a bunch of lilacs on the casket. Then Andrew Helgeline, the first of Bell's victims to be exhumed from her secret graveyard, was lowered to his final resting place. Apart from one rainy day when work was suspended, Louis Schultz would conduct his macabre prospecting for a week. Besides the watches, he would turn up several corroded knives, parts of a gilded picture frame, a plain gold ring, some keys, a belt buckle, a few bone fragments, and the remnants of a book on anatomy. The ashes, however, yielded no trace of the teeth. Large crowds of spectators gathered at the farm each day to watch Schultz work. Among them was a trio of Pinkerton detectives brought in at the suggestion of Sheriff Smutzer to help gather evidence against Ray Lamphere. Their presence did not sit well with Ray's lawyer, Wirt Warden, who issued a caustic statement to the press. Alluding to the questionable tactics of which Pinkerton operatives were often accused, Warden flatly declared that evidence is now being deliberately manufactured to make it fit the theory of the detectives. There was no doubt in his mind, said Warden, that the gold teeth of Mrs. Ganesse, with special identification marks of the dentist, will be found. Just before noon on Tuesday, May 19th, Warden's prediction was fulfilled when, moments after shoveling a large load of ashes into his sluice box, Schultz came up with a pair of dental bridges, an upper and lower. "They're found!" shouted Sheriff Smutzer, tossing his leather cap high in the air. Taking the bridges from the grinning miner, Smutzer hopped in his car, sped into town, and made directly for the office of Bell's dentist, Ira Norton. Dr. Norton had no difficulty identifying the prostheses. The upper bridge was the work of another dentist. Bell had been fitted with it in Chicago before moving to LaPorte, and was wearing it when Norton first examined her. The lower bridge was his own handiwork, four porcelain incisors backed with 18-karat gold and anchored two molars on either side of her jaw. There was, he told reporters, no mistaking the maker of the dummy teeth, which bear my private style of workmanship. This lower bridge is positively the one I made for Mrs. Ganesh.
What's to have prevented Mrs. Ganesh from having removed the teeth and thrown them into the fire before she left? Asked one of the reporters.
Norton pointed to a charred fragment of molar still hooked to the lower bridge. As you see, he explained, a natural tooth still adheres to the bridgework. To do what you propose, Mrs. Ganesh would have had to extract one of her own teeth.
Not everyone was convinced. Wasn't Mrs. Ganesh cunning enough to attach the bridgework to a tooth taken from one of her victims? And how was it possible that a conflagration hot enough to completely incinerate her skull would leave her false teeth so undamaged?
Norton's pronouncement, however, was sufficiently authoritative to persuade most officials that, as the LaPorte Argus Bulletin put it, again and finally, Mrs. Ganesh is dead. Just a few days earlier, Coroner Charles Mack, who had still not issued his official report on the identity of the headless female corpse found in the ruins of the farmhouse, declared that he was likely to leave the verdict open. "Coroner Mack not yet convinced that body is that of the murderess," read the headline in the Argus Bulletin. The discovery of the two sets of bridgework changed his mind. At 4 p.m. on Wednesday, May 20th, Mack filed his report with the clerk of the court. "It is my verdict," it concluded, "that the body is that of Belle Ganesh, that she came to death through felonious homicide, and that the perpetrator thereof is, to me, unknown." 2 days later, Friday, May 22nd, a grand jury returned indictments against Ray Lamphere, charging him with arson and the first-degree murders of Belle Ganesh, her three children, and Andrew Helgeline.
Part 3. The State of Indiana versus Ray Lamphere. 27. Ganeshville. In mid-May, at the height of the Ganesh mania, when stories about the female Bluebeard dominated the front pages of dailies throughout the Midwest, prominent LaPorte shoelace manufacturer F. W. McDonald made a business trip to Cincinnati and St. Louis. Upon his return, he sent a concerned letter to the editor of the LaPorte Argus Bulletin. Rather than their usual salutations, "Why, hello, Mac, you're looking well, how's the missus?" and so on, the wholesalers he met had to a man greeted him with macabre jests. "Well, Mac, I see you haven't been killed yet. Glad to see you, Mac, I thought all the men in LaPorte were dead," and the like. It was clear to McDonald that the Ganesh tragedy had terribly besmirched the reputation of LaPorte. He was writing, therefore, to urge our officials, both city and county, to do whatever they could to dispel the dark shadow cast over their community by the Ganesh case and to make good the fair name of LaPorte. McDonald's wish that the world would cease associating LaPorte with its most infamous inhabitant would never come true. Long after the Ganesh property had passed into the hands of other owners, tourists from throughout the country would flock to the site, searching the yard for the spots where Belle's victims had once lain, and tramping through the adjacent orchard, ruining the apple trees by breaking off branches as souvenirs. Travelers to and from LaPorte would elicit responses similar to the one experienced by a woman named Ford. On a train ride back to Memphis after a visit to LaPorte in 1913, she handed her ticket to the porter, who took one look at her city of departure and gasped, "Ganeshville!" "He knew all about the Ganesh case," reported Mrs. Ford's daughter, "and he was very disturbed about it. And for the rest of the journey, he kept his distance." There were some in LaPorte who swore that Belle continued to haunt the area. In early July, Daniel Hudson was driving a wagon load of hay past the Ganesh farm when, so he claimed, he saw through the trees Mrs. Ganesh and a strange man walking in the orchard. His daughter Eldora reported a similar sighting. According to her story, she was out on McClung Road one day in July when she saw a buggy coming toward her, drawn by a beautiful dappled gray horse I had seen tied up at Belle's gate once that winter. Then the buggy came closer, and it was Belle.
That same day, two boys walking by the Pine Lake Cemetery spotted a heavily veiled woman stop to take a drink from a water pump. When she lifted her veil, they, too, recognized Bell. Another witness, identified in accounts only as the town scavenger, had a similar chilling encounter. Driving by Bell's farm one rainy summer evening, he saw a woman dressed in black alight from a buggy and go fumbling around on the ground near the southeast corner of the house, as though searching for something. When he stopped his team to untangle the reins, she returned to her rig muttering, "That money ain't here." All at once, the lightning flashed. When he saw who it was, he went cold and numb, and drove on to town as fast as I could. In light of these and other accounts, one observer counseled that the best way to rid the community of Mrs. Ganesh's baleful presence was to pile all her remaining goods in a great heap and purge them in a purifying bonfire. Instead, the town held an auction. Arranged by her executor, Wesley Fogle, the sale took place on Friday, May 29th. Like the festive outings to the farm that had become known as Ganesh Sundays, the event drew an enormous crowd, as many as 5,000 people, according to some estimates. By the time the auction ended, every item had been snapped up, bidders paying as much as 10 times the original cost for the privilege of owning one of the female Bluebeard's kitchen utensils or gardening tools. Belle's border collie, Prince, and her children's pony fetched the highest prices, $107 and $205 respectively. Both animals, along with two chickens, an old house cat and her kittens, and a few miscellaneous relics, were purchased by a huckster named W.W. Hans, who put them on display at Chicago's Luna Park. To the editor of one Indiana newspaper, the purchasers of Mrs. Ganesh's personal effects, the memorials of a she-devil whose like has not been known, were making themselves vulnerable to insidious forces. Citing the paranormal theory of psychometry, the belief that physical objects retain the residual life energy of their former owners, the writer warned that Bell's belongings possessed an aura of evil that might infect anyone who came into contact with them. Those foolish enough to have spent the high dollar to obtain these blood-spattered goods were behaving as recklessly as a mother would be to buy rattlesnakes as playthings for her children. On the afternoon of Wednesday, June 17th, under the supervision of Undertaker Austin Cutler, the remains of the woman officially identified as Belle Ganesh, along with the corpses of the three Ganesh children, were loaded onto the Lakeshore train to Chicago. Arrived at Union Depot, the caskets were transferred into the mortuary wagon of a local undertaker, who proceeded directly to City Hall for the burial permits. At 10 a.m. the following morning, the four bodies were unceremoniously interred in the Forest Lake Cemetery. No service was conducted, and no relatives were present, Bell's sister, Mrs. Nellie Larson, refusing to attend. Readers of the LaPorte Weekly Herald learned of the funeral in an article published on June 25th. Its headline read, "Mrs. Ganesh Dead at Last." Not everyone, however, shared that belief. Despite the coroner's verdict and the interment at Forest Lake Cemetery, at least 75% of the people in and about LaPorte are convinced that the arch-murderess is still alive and in hiding, wrote journalist Arthur James Pegler. Elsewhere in the country, sightings of the female Bluebeard continued to be reported on a regular basis. In the last week of June, less than 2 weeks after the funeral, the New York Times reported that the Detroit police were holding two young women who are said to have met Mrs. Ganesh since her supposed body was found in the ruins of her home. After receiving a telephone call from the sheriff of Hillsdale, Michigan, announcing that he had arrested Mrs. Ganesh, Deputy Antis and Police Chief Cochran made an overnight trip to that city, only to find that the woman in custody was a fortune teller of some nomadic tribe weighing perhaps 150 pounds and without any resemblance to the murderess. Later that summer, Bell was spotted in Birmingham, Alabama, Minneapolis, Minnesota, Portland, Maine, Passaic, New Jersey, and Galveston, Texas, where she was seen boarding the Hamburg American liner Dania prior to its departure for Hamburg, Germany. Two men claimed to have seen Mrs. Ganesh on trains passing through Texas. In late summer, a traveling salesman named George L. Robinson told police that While riding the Katy Flyer to Denison, he was standing at the water cooler, drawing a cup of water, when a woman in deep mourning approached and asked for a drink. In raising the cup to her mouth, she removed part of the veil, and I at once recognized her as Mrs. Guinness. When I spoke to her and called her by name, she suddenly turned and went back to her seat in a hurry, and after packing a few things that she carried, left the train at the next station. A few months later, Henrik Fritz, former resident of LaPorte, reported a similar experience aboard a train from Fort Worth to Denver. Passing through a Pullman car, he saw Belle emerge from the lavatory. Recognizing Fritz, she immediately dropped a heavy veil over her face, hurried back into the lavatory, and locked herself inside. Fritz's reported sighting of the living Mrs. Guinness appeared in the press on October 9, 1908, 1 month to the day before Ray Lamphere was put on trial for her murder. 28. The Maypole. Interviewed in his cell on the eve of his trial, Ray stoutly maintained his innocence, as he had from the start. "They can twist and turn the evidence all they like, but if they prove that I set fire to the house, they will have to do it by false testimony," he declared. "I have led a pretty loose life, maybe, and possibly I drank too much at times, but there are others who have done as bad as me who are walking the streets of LaPorte today. I know nothing about the House of Crime, as they call it. Sure, I worked for Mrs. Guinness for a time, but I didn't see her kill anybody, and I didn't know she had killed anybody." Speaking to reporters, his aged mother Hannah proclaimed her unwavering faith in her boy. "With my own fingers, I made all the clothes Ray wore until he was 10 years of age," she said in a tremulous voice as she dabbed at her eyes with a handkerchief. "I sewed love into every stitch. He was my heart, my life, during his childhood. Every day that he has been in jail, my heart has ached for him. God knows, and I know, that he is not guilty. He has written this to me, and he has never told a lie to me in his life." In a somber column published in the LaPorte Weekly Herald, editor Edward Molloy reminded his readers that the sole reason for the trial of Ray Lamphere was to determine whether it was his hands that applied the torch to the house on the hill, or whether he is innocent of the atrocity that has been charged to him. "It is not a show," he stressed. "Its purpose is not to furnish entertainment either for spectators in the courtroom or readers of the daily press." As it happened, the same page of the Herald carried a prominent advertisement for an actual show that was about to open at Hall's Theater in LaPorte. Father James Lawrence Vaughan's grand moral play, A Woman of the West, featuring, among other highlights, the most reverential church scene ever written, and a carload of scenic effects, including mountain stagecoach and horses. The show would earn plaudits from local reviewers and draw appreciative audiences willing to pay anywhere from 25 cents to $1 per ticket. Still, it would not prove nearly as popular as Ray Lamphere's trial, which, despite Editor Molloy's admonition, would be the biggest show in town. The proceedings got underway on the morning of Monday, November 9, 1908. The onlookers, crammed into the upper-floor courtroom, were struck by the defendant's air of jaunty confidence as he was led in by Deputy Sheriff Antis shortly before 10 a.m. Apart from the jailhouse pallor he had acquired during his six-month incarceration, Ray seemed healthy and alert, and, in a new store-bought suit and necktie, clean collar, and freshly polished shoes, far better groomed than his neighbors had ever seen him. During the noon recess, he seemed positively carefree as he posed for the flashlight cameras of the newspapermen from the various Chicago dailies. His lawyer, Wirt Warden, was a figure of some renown in the community. 3 years earlier, he had been involved in a case that, while not nearly as sensational as the current one, generated a good deal of local attention. On that occasion, however, he was not the attorney, but one of the defendants. In December 1904, two sisters, Mrs. Stella Luna and Mrs. Mary Savinsky, residents of Michigan City, Indiana, were arrested for shoplifting furs from the Herman Zeese dry goods store. At their trial in early 1905, their defense attorneys, Warden and his law partner, LaPorte Mayor Lemuel Darrow, produced a witness, Mrs. Rose Duck, who identified herself as a sales clerk at a Chicago department store
and testified that she had sold the furs to the two women the previous March. Both defendants were acquitted. A subsequent investigation, however, revealed that Mrs. Duck, whose real name was Boyce, was a phony witness who had been paid $25 by the defense team to lie on the stand. In March 1905, a committee appointed by Judge John C. Richter of LaPorte submitted a two-page report concluding that Darrow and Warden, along with a third attorney involved in the case, John E. Talbot of South Bend, had conspired, confederated, and connived in procuring Mrs. Duck to commit the crime of perjury. At their trial in January 1906, Darrow and Talbot were found guilty of unprofessional conduct and permanently disbarred from the practice of law in Indiana. Wharton, however, was acquitted. Presiding at Ray's trial was the same Judge Richter who had ordered the investigation into the conduct of Warden and his associates that led to the disbarment proceedings. Now, after overruling the defense's motion that the indictment be quashed, he directed that all witnesses be excluded from the courtroom during jury selection, as requested by the state. It would take 4 days to impanel the jury. 115 talesmen would be questioned. Solid citizens, mostly farmers and merchants, ranging in age from 31 to 72. Each was asked the same set of questions. Had they read of the case? Did they know Mrs. Ganesse? Had they formed any opinion as to whether she was dead or alive? Were they acquainted with Ray Lamphere? Had they arrived at any fixed belief about his guilt or innocence? Could they be impartial? Unsurprisingly, the majority were rejected after admitting that, having followed the case closely in the local papers, they had reached firm conclusions both about Ray's involvement and Mrs. Ganesse's ultimate fate. With little of substance to report during this protracted and tedious process, Henry Burr Darling, editor of the Argus Bulletin, found various colorful ways to keep his readers diverted. A writer given much to strained, often bizarrely incongruous metaphors, he outdid himself on November 10th with a front-page piece in which he compared the coming task of the Lamphere jury to a May Day celebration. In the spotlight is the maypole, and stretching from its top are 12 long ribbons, each juror holding a ribbon. The entire case of the prosecution hangs on conclusive proof that the Ganesse woman is dead. Otherwise, the maypole falls in a crash, and the state's argument is broken and shattered. If, on the taking of evidence, the jurors are persuaded as to the death of the woman, the maypole stands. But to convict Ray Lamphere, the state must play the right music. The jurors will refuse to budge from their positions, and the ceremony will be over unless, on each of the ribbons, the state stamps in indelible letters the name of Ray Lamphere. Circumstantial evidence must be so woven about this prisoner as to dissipate the last shred of reasonable doubt. In that event, mystery unraveled, Belle Ganesse dead, and Ray Lamphere inseparably connected with her death and the deaths of her children, the jurymen might well turn in ribbons blackened by human murder. Unless this spiderweb of circumstantial evidence is spun around the prisoner, the ribbons will be handed back as they were received, white and spotless. The seventh juror had just been selected on Tuesday the 10th when, shortly before the afternoon adjournment, Lamphere's thin cheeks paled, he uttered a weak cry as if in pain, and his head fell on the table in front of him. He tried to rise, and blood gushed from his nose and his mouth. Deputy Sheriff Leroy Marr immediately hurried to Lamphere's side, helped him to his feet, and half-led, half-carried him into the cooler air of the corridor. While the courtroom buzzed with consternation, Sheriff Smutzer rushed out into the hallway after Lamphere and the deputy. He returned a few minutes and announced that Lamphere had suffered only a slight hemorrhage and would shortly be able to return. Though Chicago papers speculated that Lamphere's collapse might jeopardize the entire trial, he returned to the courtroom the following morning, seemingly no worse for wear. Interviewed by reporters, however, the physician who attended the inmates at the LaPorte jail struck an ominous note expressing his fear that Lamphere is afflicted with incipient tuberculosis. It was not a report on Ray's physical condition, but a piece on his supposed psychological makeup that dominated Wednesday's coverage by the Chicago Daily Journal. Headlined, Hate, Cowardice, Predominating Elements in Ray Lamphere Told by Character Expert. The article featured a full-face portrait of Ray, with a dozen arrows pointing to various facial and cranial features. According to the author, J.M. Fitzgerald, M.D., identified as phrenologist and expert in character study, Ray was exactly the sort that Mrs. Ganesh would pick from all her acquaintances for her assistant, her man Friday, weak mentally and morally, and yet as stealthy as a cat, with less sense of gratitude than many members of the feline species. The first impression that one gets from his picture is that here is a mixture of the human and the tiger cat. The head is low in the frontal brain, and especially pinched in the upper temples and forehead at the seat of ideality, or refinement of mind, benevolence or sympathy, veneration or respect for law, human, divine, causality or logical reason, and power to comprehend consequences innately. He has none of the initiative Mrs. Ganesh possessed in abundance for wholesale murder, but a person of his type would readily consent in carrying out the afterwork and doing away with the individual if he were crippled or maimed into helplessness. He is naturally a coward, but would be revengeful and full of deadly hate for anyone who he believed had sufficient influence to jeopardize his liberty and who failed to give him money for the purpose of gratifying his animal nature, which possesses him body and soul. His whole head and face indicate the dissolute man of perverted appetites. The eyes are cat-like, watchful, cunning, and cruel. The nose is well-suited to the feral, cat-like eyes. It further bears out the impression of stealth and low ideals. Summing up his highly scientific and unbiased study, Fitzgerald concluded that Lamphere's phrenology and physiognomy indicate a low-grade animal type of man of weak mental and moral faculties, whose animal propensities early in life instinctively crowded out of his mind any good training or fine example his mother might have tried to inculcate. He has these many years been antisocial in the higher sense, and the more human parts of his brain have become atrophied from lack of normal function. That same day, Wednesday, November 11th, 24 hours after publishing his hopelessly muddled Mayday piece, Harry Burr Darling ran an eye-catching story headlined, "Sensational Find of Bones," resurrecting a controversy that had been seemingly laid to rest several months before. In the last week of May, State's Attorney Smith had received a letter from one Julius Trulson, an inmate in the Vernon, Texas City Jail. A small-time swindler who had been going under the name Jonathan G. Thaw, supposedly a cousin of the notorious Pittsburgh millionaire Harry K. Thaw, slayer of celebrity architect Stanford White. The 22-year-old Trulson claimed that he had been an accomplice of Belle Ganesh in several of her murders. According to his literate and compellingly detailed letter, he and Belle had become acquainted in January 1903 when, after answering one of her ads, he met her in Chicago and was offered employment by her. She told him that she practiced an illegal form of surgery, by which she meant abortions, and occasionally had bodies to dispose of, and that she would pay him well for helping her. 4.5 years later, in June 1907, now married to a young woman named May Frances O'Reilly of Rochester, New York, Trulson, having tired of his wife, took her to the Ganesh farm to have her put out of the way. He and Ray Lamphere then buried her body, along with that of another victim, near the railroad tracks in the rear of the farm. In the following months, he assisted Lamphere in disposing of 6 other bodies at the Ganesh farm. One evening in March 1908, fearing that Ocelot Helgeline's inquiries into his brother's fate were about to expose her crimes, Belle asked Trulson to burn down the place and flee with her to Frisco. Trulson cautioned her not to panic and thereby draw suspicion on herself. In town that night, he and Ray discussed the matter and decided that we had to put her out of the way before she did away with both of us, so we tossed a coin to see which of us was to do the job. Lamphere lost, and it was decided that he was to enter at night and knock Belle and her kids in the head, and then set fire to the place to cover her crimes and ours. I left that night and went to Chicago. Eventually he made his way to Texas, where he was arrested for passing forged checks. He was riding now because his guilty conscience haunted him most every night. In contrast to the countless crank letters sent to LaPorte officials since the start of the Ganesse affair, Trulson's missive sounded so persuasive that Sheriff Smutzer was immediately dispatched to Texas. Arrived in Vernon on May 21st, Smutzer conducted a lengthy interview with the prisoner, who ultimately swore to and signed a 19-page confession. No sooner had he been led back to his cell, however, than Trulson recanted everything he had said, explaining that the whole thing was a lie designed to get him out of the hands of the Texas authorities. A subsequent investigation into his background revealed that he was locked up in the Elmira Reformatory during the entire time Belle was engaged in her crimes, that his ex-wife Mae Frances O'Reilly was very much alive, and that he was addicted to drugs which sometimes aid the imaginative faculties. Interviewed at the family home, a three-story private residence at 34 West 47th Street in Manhattan, Trulson's brother Harry flatly declared that his brother was insane. He was struck by a trolley car at 23rd Street and Broadway 5 years ago, and he has not been right since. Despite Trulson's retraction and the other hard evidence that he had concocted the confession, some people continued to believe that there must be some truth to it. It was so minute in detail, they insisted, so full of things that could only be known by a person actually familiar with them, that it could not have been a complete fabrication. Among these individuals were Belle's neighbor Daniel Hudson and Deputy Sheriff Marr. In the days before the start of Ray's trial, the two men went out to the Ganesse farm and, as Harry Darling reported, made excavations in the place described in Trulson's confession, where he said bodies of victims had been buried. Though they found no bodies, they did dig up some bones, which Marr believed were human. The discovery occasioned Darling's sensational headline of November 11th. The accompanying story, however, ended on a distinctly anticlimactic note. This development is likely to have little bearing on the case on trial, except as giving some slight degree of credence to the confession of Trulson. Finally, on the afternoon of Thursday the 12th, after the rejection of 103 candidates, a jury was seated. 12 men, the youngest 34, the oldest 65, 9 of them farmers, the others a carpenter, dry goods clerk, and a salesman. They would be sequestered for the course of the trial. Not, however, in a local hotel, as was usually the case, but in the courthouse itself, where 12 cots had been set up in the jury room. They would be allowed a brief daily walk outside for some fresh air and exercise, but to ensure that they engaged in no inappropriate interactions with the public, they would be given close surveillance by Sheriff Smutzer and his deputies.
29. Smith.
At 4:30 p.m., with time still remaining before court adjourned for the day, State's Attorney Ralph N. Smith rose to make his opening statement. He would hold the jury spellbound for the 40-minute duration of his speech. One listener, Harry Burr Darling, extolled the lawyer for his unpretentious style. "Prosecutor Smith does not indulge in flowery metaphors," he wrote admiringly. "He spoke in the plainest English and straight from the shoulder. During the entire time, the dropping of a pin would have attracted attention." Darling's own preferred style, of course, was the diametrical opposite of the unembellished English he commended in Smith. His fondness for florid and overblown language was evinced yet again in his description of the defendant's reactions to the prosecutor's statement. "A remarkable change came over the prisoner during the address of Smith," wrote Darling. "He was not the same Lamphere of the jury examination, listless and apparently unconcerned. The color of his face resembled a fresh tombstone, and his eyes shone out from sunken sockets like two pieces of burning charcoal would blaze from a sheet of snow." Thanking the jurymen for their patience in the long and somewhat tedious examination process, Smith explained that owing to the widespread notoriety of the case, selecting the 12 most qualified men for the task was a matter of great importance. He stressed that, however aggressive he and his co-counsel Martin Sutherland might appear in their prosecution of the defendant, they were not out for anyone's blood. They were not agents of vengeance, but servants of the law. "We have no animosity to satisfy," he asserted.
We have no axes to grind, no spleen to vent. We are not persecuting anybody. If we sometimes get zealous, it is because of our anxiety to fulfill our duty. A dark cloud has fallen upon our county. A dastardly series of crimes have been committed in LaPorte County, and we are here to do our duty. He acknowledged that there would be very little direct evidence in the case. The guilt or innocence of the defendant would be determined almost entirely on circumstantial evidence. Of course, there was nothing unusual about that. Dark, premeditated deeds like arson were typically carried out in secrecy. As Smith put it, people, when they set out to commit a crime such as the burning of a dwelling, do not set out to do it with a brass band. Having dispensed with these preliminaries, Smith got to the heart of the matter. We charge Ray Lamphere with setting fire to the home of Belle Ganesse on April 28th while she was in it, he declared, and we expect to prove that she was burned to death there with her three children, Myrtle Sorensen, Lucy Sorensen, and Philip Ganesse. We expect to prove that when the ruins were cleared away, the charred bodies found in the ashes were those of Belle Ganesse and the children. Our position is that it does not matter whether Lamphere intended to set fire to Belle Ganesse when he set fire to her house. When we prove he did set the fire, remember the statute which says he is guilty of murder in the perpetration of arson where lives were lost, whether he intended to take a life or not. The state is not required to show that he went out there with the intention to kill Belle Ganesse in the fire. Before continuing to lay out the case against Ray, Smith paused to say a word about the woman who had brought such unwanted notoriety to LaPorte. It was not his purpose, said Smith, either to defend the character of Belle Ganesse or to drag it down. From the dismembered bodies of nine persons that were found on her premises, however, it appeared that she engaged in the wholesale slaughter of humanity. Returning to the issue at hand, Smith turned to the question of motive. By his own admission, he charged, the prisoner was a witness to the murder of Andrew K. Helgeline, a profit-sharer in the blood money, and because he did not receive what he considered a fair share of his blood money, he applied the torch to Mrs. Ganesse's home. At this dramatic accusation, Ray half-started from his chair, as if to shout a denial, only to be pulled back down by the restraining hand of his attorney. We will show by evidence, Smith went on, that in January of this year, a man by the name of Helgeline was induced by means of matrimonial advertisements and letters to come from South Dakota to the Ganesse farm, bringing his worldly wealth with him. We shall prove that on the night of January 14th, Belle Ganesse sent Ray Lamphere to Michigan City on a wild goose chase on the pretext of leaving some horses there for someone who was to call for them. Lamphere was to stay in Michigan City. This was the night Helgeline disappeared. Instead of staying at Michigan City, as he was instructed to do, continued Smith, Lamphere came back on the streetcar and got off near the powerhouse, and the evidence will show that he made the remark to a man on the car that he was going over there to see what the old woman was doing. We will prove that Lamphere bobbed up like Johnny on the spot and assisted Mrs. Ganesse in the dastardly work of disposing of Helgeline's body. Helgeline had $3,000 on his person, and evidence will be introduced to show that Lamphere got part of the money. It was over money matters that Lamphere and Mrs. Ganesse fell out. Smith briefly sketched the growing animosity between the pair. Mrs. Ganesse had Lamphere arrested for trespass. Altogether, she had him arrested three times. She served notice on him to keep away from her place. For his part, Lamphere had been overheard to make insinuating threats against his former employer. We can prove, asserted Smith, that Lamphere said, I can get the old woman down on her knees any time I want to. I know something about her that would send her to the penitentiary. Matters came to a head, recounted Smith, on April 27th. After coming into town that afternoon with his current employer, John Wheatbrook, Lamphere had gone to spend the night at the home of Lizzie Smith. Nigger Liz, as Smith, like everyone else in town, had no qualms about calling her. Lamphere had set his alarm clock for 3 a.m. and started out from Smith's home about 20 minutes after 3. The fire occurred about 4 o'clock, Smith continued. Instead of going by a direct route through the city park to the farm of his cousin to get a broad axe, we will show he took the Ganesh Road. By his own statement, we will show he was on the spot at the time of the fire. When asked why he did not wake up the people when he saw the house burning, he replied, "I didn't think it was any of my business." We will prove he ran along the foot of the hills afterwards, past the cemetery to get on another road, and wound up at his cousin's farm at 5:30.
Lamphere's movements that morning clearly pointed to his guilt. So did his reaction when taken into custody.
At 7 o'clock that evening, when the deputy sheriff went to the Wheatbrook farm to arrest Lamphere, he said, "Ray, get on your coat and come along to town." Ray's answer showed he had the fire in mind. He said, "Did those folks burn up in that fire?"
"What fire?" asked the sheriff.
"Why, that house," answered Ray.
The foremost thing on Lamphere's mind was the burning of that house.
Of course, Smith conceded, to convict Lamphere of murder, the state was obligated to prove the corpus delicti, or that Mrs. Ganesh is dead. Undoubtedly, the defense would seek to convince the jury of the opposite. Indeed, Wharton had already let it be known that he planned to issue a subpoena for Bell, summoning her to appear as a witness for the defense. Declaring that he certainly did not want to convict a man for the murder of anybody who isn't dead, Smith proceeded to outline the evidence he would offer to prove that Mrs. Ganesh died and was burned in the fire. "On the day before the fire," he related, "Mrs. Ganesh went to attorney Lelider in LaPorte and drew up her will, and at Mr. Lelider's suggestion rented a safety deposit box in the bank, and into that box she put the will and her private papers and some $700 in money. After that, she went to Minich's grocery store for her week's supply of groceries, and she also got toys and games for her children, spending some $8 or $10. That night," he continued, "Joe Maxson ate supper with them. About 9:30, he went up to bed, and at that time the mother and children were at the table in the home playing games, and nothing unusual had happened. The children played with the toys and games around the fireside. About 4 in the morning, Maxson was awakened. He was occupying the upper story of the frame part of the house. Mrs. Ganesh occupied the southeast corner room with the little boy. It was the custom of the children to occupy the northwest corner room. Maxson heard them retire. He was awakened by smoke in his room. There was a gale blowing that night from the northwest. He rushed to the window, and the whole interior of the brick house was on fire. Maxson beat on the door of the family apartments without success and escaped from the house. The fire had evidently been started in the outside cellarway. Others came on the scene. They climbed to the room occupied by the children, but there was no one in the room. Our contention will be that Mrs. Ganesh became suffocated and died, that the children were awakened by the smoke and ran over to their mother's room into the thickest of the fire and were suffocated. The house was completely burned. Not a bit of wood was left. The bodies were burned in the hot debris for 12 hours. 200 pails of water were necessary to cool the hot bricks so the bodies could be got at. All four were found together. That of Mrs. Ganesh was lying on the back with the body of the boy clasped in her left arm. That the charred female corpse was that of Mrs. Ganesh would be shown by hard evidence. "We shall prove by the coroner's inquest," said Smith, "that the coroner found on the hand a ring or rings belonging to Mrs. Ganesh. We shall prove by a reputable dentist here in LaPorte that he did crown and bridge work for Mrs. Ganesh. We will produce those teeth and also her upper teeth. I think you will agree when the evidence is all in that the old woman is dead." Of course, it was natural to feel that Mrs. Ganesh got what was coming to her. That sentiment, however, must have no bearing on the jury's decision. "I want to impress upon your mind," Smith stressed, "that the principal, the salient points in the case are these. Did Ray Lamphere burn this house? Did he feloniously and willfully do this? Did Belle Ganesh and her 3 children meet death because of this act? If we prove beyond a reasonable doubt an affirmative answer to these questions, and I believe we can," concluded Smith,
We shall expect a verdict accordingly.
30. Corpus Delicti. After their first night in what the LaPorte Weekly Herald described as their comfortable quarters, a small deliberation room crammed with a dozen cots, the jurors were taken for a walk by Bailiff Carl Matz, then escorted to breakfast at the Hotel Tea Garden, where they were permitted to peruse the morning papers from which all references to the trial had been removed. Having caught up on the other news of the day, the self-inflicted wound of an amateur magician named Don V. Smythe, who accidentally shot himself in the hand with a blank cartridge while giving a sleight-of-hand performance in Noblesville, the deplorable lack of appreciation shown by Miss Cora Harness, who failed to reward ticket agent Henry Benford when he found the much-prized gold watch she had lost during a shopping expedition, and the plans of the International Egg Carrier and Paper Company to open a factory in LaPorte, the jurors were led back to the courthouse for the first day of testimony. In the weeks leading up to the trial, the state had issued subpoenas for 40 witnesses. All had been found except one, the gold miner Louis Schultz, who had produced the dental bridge declared to be that of Bell Ganess. Evidently the old prospector, possessed of the perennial optimism of his breed, had decamped for the West in pursuit of the big strike that had so far eluded him. To establish the corpus delicti, proof that Mrs. Ganess had in fact been murdered, the prosecution began by calling the coroner, Dr. Charles S. Mack. A graduate of Harvard and the Columbia College of Physicians and Surgeons, where he received his M.D. in 1882, Mack had gone on to teach at the medical school of the University of Michigan before entering into private practice, first in Chicago and then in LaPorte. He had held the office of coroner for the past 2 years. Snowy-haired and snowy-bearded, the 51-year-old physician was described by one chronicler as resembling an Old Testament prophet, an apt analogy, since he had recently been ordained as a Swedenborgian minister and announced his intention to resign from his medical practice and take up a new life as a pastor in Toledo, Ohio. Indeed, just a few days before, a farewell banquet had been held for him at the Methodist Church, where his fellow members of the LaPorte Physicians Club presented him with a beautiful gold-headed cane, symbolic of the upright manner in which Mack had ever walked as a physician, as a citizen, and as a man. From the point of view of any audience members anticipating high drama, Mack's testimony got the proceedings off to a disappointing start. Questioned by Smith's associate, Martin Sutherland, the coroner stated that he had first seen the body of a woman and three children on the afternoon of the fire. They were badly burned. One of the children had a hole in the forehead. The head of the adult body was missing, and also the right leg was burned below the knee. The left foot was missing, and one arm was off. I disremember as to whether or not the hand was attached to the arm. Asked what disposition he had made of the bodies, Mack replied that they had been taken to Cutler's morgue, where he had called in four autopsists, Doctors Gray, Wilcox, Long, and Meyer, to conduct the post-mortem. As for himself, he did not make any minute examination of the bodies. I did not pay any more attention to the bodies than in any ordinary case. It quickly became clear to Sutherland that Mack would be unable to provide much useful testimony concerning the corpus delicti without consulting the notes he had made on the day of the fire. Mack, however, had failed to bring the notes with him. Realizing the futility of obtaining an accurate description of the bodies, unless the mind of the witness were refreshed by the notes, wrote Harry Darling, a somewhat exasperated Sutherland abandoned that line of questioning. A pair of sealed jars sat on the prosecution table. Retrieving the larger of the two, Sutherland undid the lid and removed the contents. A few badly charred bones recovered from the cellar along with the bodies. He then showed them, one at a time, to the witness, who identified them as a heel bone, a left jawbone, and, insofar as he was able to judge, a seventh vertebrae. The second jar contained something that Mack was able to identify only as animal tissue. It was difficult to see what advantage the prosecution had achieved by exhibiting these ghastly relics, though, to judge from the excited stir among the spectators, it was a high point for courtroom sensation seekers. Worden's cross-examination, which began a few moments later, proved such an utter rout that an audible sigh of relief rippled through the crowd when Dr. Mack, a beloved figure in the community, was finally permitted to step from the witness chair. Under the defense attorney's relentless grilling, the coroner was compelled to admit that he was not present when the bodies were discovered, that he did not know the condition of the bodies when found, that he could not state whether the arms of the adult were disjointed or not, that he did not weigh the body of the adult person, that he did not know there was a question as to the identity of that body, that he could not say whether any of the vertebrae were missing, that he had no idea how many cervical vertebrae there are in a human person, that he did not examine the upper terminus of the spine with any care, that he could not tell from its appearance whether the leg had been cut off or burned off, or whether the head had been burned off or charred after it had been severed, that he had not examined the hole in the skull of the child, could not undertake to say what caused the hole, and had not checked to see if there were holes in any heads of the other children. By the time Worden got around to questioning Mac about the three charred bones, the coroner was so worn down that his testimony lapsed into self-contradiction. "Are you positive?" asked Worden, holding up one of the fragments. "That this bone I show you is a cervical vertebra?"
"I am not," said Mac.
"Well, doctor, are you positive that this bone I present is a jawbone?"
"It is."
"Is it the bone of a human being?" Worden pressed. Mac let out a sigh.
"I do not know.
Would you state, Dr. Mac, from present observation, that this bone is from the upper or lower maxillary?" Just a moment before, Mac asserted that he was positive the bone was a jawbone. Now, bedeviled to the end of his patience, he snapped, "I could not positively state that it is a bone at all." With that, the coroner's ordeal came to an end. The first medical testimony for the prosecution, as one historian put it, had been turned into a triumph for the defense. The state fared somewhat better in the afternoon session. The first witnesses called to the stand were Drs. Harry H. Long, Franklin T. Wilcox, and J. Lucian Gray, three of the autopsists called in by Mac. While the examination of Long and Wilcox, who had conducted the postmortems on the two Gunness girls, was somewhat perfunctory, Dr. Gray's testimony, as one reporter noted, proved to be of material value to the state. The former coroner of LaPorte County and one-time coroner's physician in Cook County, Gray, under questioning by Sutherland, estimated that, before shrinking in the fire, the body of the adult woman would have stood 5 feet, 4.44 inches, and weighed about 200 pounds. The tissue of the abdomen was fatty, about 2 inches thick, and the breasts were fat and large, traits that corresponded to Bell's physique. Moreover, while acknowledging that he could not definitively state the cause of death, it was his opinion that death was due to asphyxia, a crucial point for the state, which was seeking to prove that Bell had been killed in the fire set by the defendant. In part, said Gray, his opinion was based on the condition of the tightly clutched fingers of the corpse's right hand. "Muscles are contracted that way in all cases of suffocation," he explained. Under Warden's aggressive cross-examination, however, Gray conceded that the clenching of the corpse's right hand could have been a post-mortem spasmodic contraction caused by strychnine poisoning. He also admitted that he could not tell whether the body's left arm and right leg had been cut off or burned off. His explanation of how he had computed the probable weight of the woman also raised eyebrows, particularly among the housewives in the audience. "Including the arm, the charred remains weighed 73 pounds," explained Gray. "By comparing it with other meats which had been cooked, I estimated that it had shrunk about two-thirds." By this logic, as one crime historian points out, a 9-pound standing rib roast, when cooked, would end up as a stingy 3 pounds on the dinner table. Observers agreed that by the time he was done, Worden had scored an impressive list of reasonable doubts by suggesting that the dead woman had not died of suffocation, but been killed with strychnine and partially dismembered, and that Dr. Gray's identification of the 73-pound remains as Mrs. Gunness was close to wishful thinking.
As for the other witnesses, wrote Harry Burr Darling, it is the general opinion that they failed utterly to establish the state's contention as to Mrs. Ganesh's death. Dr. Mack's testimony in particular is considered practically worthless in the way of identification of the adult body. Today, proclaimed Darling, was decidedly Lamphere's day.
31. The Dentist. For the sake of the jurors, who would otherwise be forced to spend two idle days largely confined to their makeshift quarters, all the principals involved in the trial deemed it advisable to hold court on Saturday. The morning began with an unforeseen setback by the state. Following the completion of Dr. Gray's cross-examination and a brief reappearance by Coroner Mack, who testified that, besides the four bodies retrieved from the rubble, 10 decomposed corpses were removed from the place, the prosecution called its next witness, Dr. Johann H. William Meyer. A native of Buhr, Germany, who emigrated to the United States at 17 and still spoke with a pronounced accent, Meyer had begun his working life as a salesman for the Weil and Fox dry goods firm in LaPorte before entering Rush Medical College in Chicago. Following his graduation in 1876, he interned at the Cook County Hospital, then returned to LaPorte where, apart from a year's study in Heidelberg and Vienna, he had practiced ever since, specializing in diseases of the ear and eye. In addition to his large private practice, he served on the faculty of the Practical School of Watchmaking in LaPorte, where he lectured on the anatomy and diseases of the eye to aspiring opticians, and held the post of local physician for the Lakeshore and Michigan Southern Railroad. Despite his high standing in the community, Meyer would find himself in serious legal trouble just a few years after Lamphere's trial, when he was charged with murder for performing an abortion on a local farmer's wife, Florence Greening, that resulted in her death. Mrs. Greening's husband, William, who turned state's evidence in return for immunity, was the primary witness against him at his 10-day trial in February 1913. After 15 hours of deliberation, however, the jury would acquit him. At the autopsies of the four corpses recovered from the fire, Meyer had performed the post-mortem on 4-year-old Philip Ganesh. Asked now about the condition of the little boy's body, he provided a description that, though delivered in a dry, clinical tone, was ghastly enough to induce shudders in the listeners. The body was severely burned, said Meyer. The legs were burned off at the knees entirely. The forehead was burned away, exposing the brain. The back was badly burned. The spinal cord was exposed. How much of the limbs was burned off? Asked Sutherland. Nearly to the knees. Were the arms burned off? One of the arms was missing, said Meyer. The lungs were partially preserved by cooking. The heart was contracted, containing no particle of blood. All the organs were well cooked. Sutherland paused for a moment, as though to let the jurors fully take in the hideous picture. Clearly, the person responsible for inflicting such horrors on a 4-year-old child deserved no mercy. Unfortunately for the prosecution, its own witness was about to raise serious doubts as to the identity of that person. "Could you form any fixed idea as to the cause of death?" asked Sutherland. Meyer replied that he could not. "What is your professional opinion, doctor?" asked Sutherland. "Contraction of the heart, like some case of poisoning," said Meyer. "From the examination of the stomach, I would say that the contraction was probably due to strychnine." Any suggestion, of course, that Bell and her children had not been killed by arson undermined the state's argument against Lamphere. Here, as one writer says, was a prosecution witness in effect testifying for the defense. Sutherland, clearly caught off guard by Meyer's response, quickly brought his examination to an end. Meyer helped the defense again when Warden took over a moment later. Ask if there had been any ecchymotic spots on the little boy's body, small discolorations caused by ruptured blood vessels, a common sign of suffocation. Meyer replied with an emphatic, "No, sir, none." He also confirmed that there was a hole in the boy's forehead, reinforcing the notion that the children had died at Bell's hands before the conflagration. Warden faced a much tougher challenge when Bell's dentist, Dr. Ira P. Norton, took the stand. Like Dr. Meyer, the 40-year-old Norton had gotten his degree from Rush Medical College, financing his education with a job as an engineer on the Chicago Elevated Railroad. A few years before the trial, he had won wide recognition in professional circles for his invention of a patented dental forceps equipped with a detachable lancet. Though the previous direct